Welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. I don't know about you, but I've always considered Andrew Jackson a Southerner, perhaps because growing up in Tennessee, little children learned that three men who hailed from Tennessee became president of the United States: James K. Polk, Andrew Johnson, and Andrew Jackson. There's a great deal of scholarship about the Jacksonian era, but our guest today says very little of it views our seventh chief executive through the prism of his Southern roots. Dr. Mark R. Cheatham, who earned his master's degree here at MTSU, takes that approach in his book, Andrew Jackson, Southerner. Cheatham is a native of Cleveland, Tennessee, and an associate professor of history at Cumberland University in Lebanon, where he is also director of the history program. We'll take a new look at Old Hickory after these words from MTSUnews.com.
Here are some of the stories now on MTSUnews.com, the university's news and information website. The MTSU Student Union has been recognized as a Gold Citation winner in American School and University Magazine's Educational Interiors Showcase. Contest judges noted that, quote, each space is exciting and non-formulaic in its design solution. The $16 million Student Services and Admissions Building is slated to open March 17th. The facility will include the MT One Stop, a site that will bring admissions, financial aid, scheduling, course registration, enrollment, and business office functions together under one roof. And Sidelines Editor-in-Chief Emily West and Photo Editor Kat Murphy toured MTSU's new science building with university officials January 15th for an edition of the student newspaper. The $147 million building extends over 257,000 square feet. For MTSU News anytime, go to MTSUnews.com.
Dr. Cheatham, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
First, let's define what it means to be Southern in the context of the times in which Jackson lived, which was from 1767 to 1845. What characteristics or qualities do you believe made Jackson a Southerner other than geography?
Well, I think geography, of course, has a lot to play with it, has a lot to do with it. The things I focus on in the biography are his slave ownership, which was not uniquely Southern when he was born, but increasingly became uniquely Southern as he lived. The concept of honor, which again is not uniquely Southern when he's born, but as he gets older, it becomes something that becomes increasingly located in the South. It's his desire for manifest destiny, which is extremely important in defining the United States in the 19th century. It's also kinship, which is something that Southerners, particularly elite Southerners like Jackson, valued very much. And it's also violence, which is an American characteristic, but within the context of the Southern region and in relationship with honor in particular, was something that characterized Jackson and a lot of elite Southern men.
Why is the passion for westward expansion part of his Southernness?
I don't really define the passion for westward expansion in quite the same way as some historians. When I talk about manifest destiny, which is the idea that God gave the North American continent to the United States, that does involve westward expansion into Texas, for example, which is something that Jackson supports. But in Jackson's case, I'm also looking at expansion into the South. So, for example, one of the things that Jackson does that is that supports manifest destiny is his removal of Native American tribes in the Southeast. To me, that is just as much about manifest destiny as moving westward. And historians have, for well over a century, talked about the westward expansion and how that exemplifies manifest destiny. But I also look at this Southern expansion as just as important in Jackson's case.
Did you find Jackson to be as belligerent and quick-tempered as some historians have led us to believe?
Yes and no. I think Jackson, certainly when he's younger, he does have a pretty violent temper, and that partly comes from his background on the frontier in North Carolina and South Carolina, and part of it may just be his Scots-Irish background as well. As he gets older, I think Jackson has developed this reputation for being violent and for being quick-tempered, and he uses that to his advantage. He manipulates people because they know this is a guy, if you cross him, you might find yourself in a duel, you might find yourself, you know, thrown out of the room, and he uses that to his advantage in his political career as president and at other times. And so it's kind of interesting to look at Jackson. People have interpreted him as being sort of this loose cannon, but he's also very calculating at times and using that particular reputation to his advantage. Very calculating.
The predecessor of Lyndon Johnson, I guess.
Perhaps. He doesn't use the same technique, but very close.
We'll take a break here. We'll be back. This is MTSU on the Record.
The Middle Tennessee Writing Project is a program that fosters the effective teaching of writing to students in kindergarten through high school. The project hosts annual summer institutes where teacher participants teach and learn from each other effective techniques of teaching writing. In addition, the project sponsors summer writers' camps for youngsters. MTSU is one of 185 sites of the National Writing Project and one of only two in Tennessee. For all the latest MTSU news and information, go to mtsunews.com.
The book is called Andrew Jackson Southerner by Dr. Mark R. Cheatham, an MTSU alumnus. How did Jackson treat his slaves?
Jackson treats his slaves, I think, like a typical slave owner. There are times when he's very generous, when he's concerned about keeping slave families together, when he's concerned about a slave who might be sick or who might be ill or dying. But then there are times when Jackson treats them like a typical slave owner, in the way that we commonly think of. So, for example, when he has runaway slaves, these are usually men who run away, Jackson treats them like you would expect. He offers rewards for their return. He orders them to be whipped or beaten in front of the other slaves to set an example so that other slaves don't run away. He also, there's one instance in the early 1820s when he's in Florida. He's the territorial governor of Florida, and his wife, Rachel, writes him and says that her slave Betty is acting up. She's laundering clothes for the neighbors, and Rachel wants her to stop, and she won't. And so Jackson writes some of the men in his household and tells them to get Betty in line, and if she won't respond to Rachel's direction, then she has to be publicly whipped. And that is something that we don't often think about with Jackson. And I guess it's because he's been depicted as a Democrat and as very democratic and for equality for so many years and so many decades. And there is certainly an element of that in his life, but there's also, when it comes to slaves, this element of him being a slave owner. These are his property, these people are his property, and he needs them to do what he wants them to do. And if they don't, then they have to suffer the punishment.
And that made him a man very much of his time and place.
Very much so. Again, I think he's typical.
And it's a white man of his time and
place. A white man, right. A white man, and an elite white man. You know, we don't talk about Jackson's, the number of slaves that he owns either. He owns, over the course of his lifetime, he probably owns at least 300 slaves. When he dies, his estate has around 160 slaves as part of his estate in Tennessee and in Mississippi. So he's not just a slave owner. He's an elite slave owner. He is one of the wealthiest men in Tennessee because of the number of slaves that he owns.
To what do you attribute the remarks that Jackson made on his deathbed about blacks and whites being together in heaven? Was that just nearer my God to thee moment, or did he come to some kind of ideological change of mind before he became critically ill? I mean, was it an intellectual change, or was it an emotional change brought on by the vulnerability of his illness and near and death?
Those deathbed words are an interesting phenomenon. There are a lot of witnesses to Jackson's death, a number of witnesses, I should say, including family members, including slaves, and they all, for the most part, report the same words, that he thought that whites and blacks, members of his family and his slaves, would be in heaven together. I think that part of it is probably just the emotion of the moment. Just because you owned slaves as property did not mean that you could not also consider them family. Now, from our perspective, that doesn't mean that they were family in the sense that we think of. But
for the 21st century thinking, that's just totally counterintuitive.
It is. But I think elite slave owners and slave owners in general could could conceive of slaves as family members at the same time that they were property.
The relationship was more complicated, especially with the house slaves as opposed to the field slaves.
Right. And so, again, that doesn't mean that they were seen as family in the sense that we think of, but slave owners could think of them as family in their own minds in a way that made sense at the same time that they owned them as property. And so I think that that's probably where Jackson's deathbed words come from, is that he's in this mindset of, these are my family members. These are the ones who were in the room with him, the slaves in the room with him, were the house slaves. And so he sees them in a different way, perhaps, than he sees the field slaves, even though they were still his property.
You came across in your research some accounts of interviews with his former slaves, mm-hmm. in which they talk about him very fondly and say that the slaves were weeping at his bedside,
right.
And I can hear African Americans saying, "Will you give me a break? What is this gun with the wind stuff you're giving me here?" Do you buy those accounts? How credible are those accounts?
Again, an interesting phenomenon in perspective. Those interviews, particularly the ones with Hannah, who was one of the house slaves, come roughly 30 to 50 years after Jackson's death. In Hannah's case in particular, she was being interviewed by white reporters. So it could be that she was telling the reporters what they wanted to hear. It could be in her old age that she did have a certain fondness for the president. It could be that she was associating herself with a famous man. I mean, he was the president. And so this was a way for her to gain some notoriety. Perhaps there was some fondness there. It's a very complicated situation in the post-Civil War years, as slaves are remembering what it was like to be owned. And in Hannah's case in particular, there's a complexity there that I don't necessarily refer to in the book, but there's a complexity there because one of her descendants in particular believes that Jackson and Hannah had a relationship with one another and that they produced a child together. And so how much credence to give to that, I'm not exactly sure. That's something I'm researching right now, as a matter of fact. But if that was true, then there's an added complexity there that we haven't even plumbed at this point.
That would go against the perception of Jackson as being 150% totally devoted to Rachel, the relationship of Andrew Jackson and Rachel Donaldson Robards. Jackson is just described as being the most loving marital relationship, mm-hmm. probably of any president short of Ronald and Nancy Reagan.
That's true. And again, I don't know how much credence to give to the Hannah story. From what I've seen in researching this particular book, Jackson, Andrew Jackson, and Rachel Jackson are devoted to one another. There's no question they are in love with each other. And Jackson, after Rachel's death in 1828, Jackson visits the garden where she's buried right outside the Hermitage and spends a lot of time there with her, talking to her, praying. So he seems to be devoted to her until his dying days. And that is certainly one aspect of Jackson that I don't think most people question, is his devotion to Rachel.
And yet this is not a man whom one could ever think of as being henpecked. It seems that he has a very distinct idea of what manhood means.
That's certainly true. And he is in control of his household. That's for certain when it comes to Rachel, when it comes to the nieces and nephews, when it comes to the nephew whom they adopted as their son, Andrew Jackson Jr. Jackson's in control. He believes that people in his household, whether they're whether his wife, whether his adopted son, whether nieces, nephews, whether slaves, they're supposed to obey him. And that comes out in particular during his presidency, during the Eaton sex scandal, which involved one of Jackson's closest friends, John Eaton, and his wife, Margaret. There was some controversy about their marriage, and Jackson spends roughly the first 2.5 years of his presidency trying to convince Washington society, trying to convince other members of the cabinet that John and Margaret were acceptable social equals and that they needed to be accorded that treatment. And he gets resistance within his household from a niece and a nephew who don't want to associate with John and Margaret. And Jackson puts his foot down and sends them back to Tennessee and insists that they have to treat John and Margaret as equals.
We'll pause again for just a moment. We'll be right back. This is MTSU on the Record.
The Tennessee Employment Relations Research Association, or TERRA, gives labor relations specialists and academics a chance to share their views and their data. TERRA wants academics and other interested in human resources and industrial relations to work together at meetings and conferences to strengthen the workplace. Many MTSU faculty belong to TERRA, which has members in 20 states and 7 nations. For all the latest MTSU news and information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking with Dr. Mark R. Cheatham, who is an associate professor of history at Cumberland University in Lebanon and an MTSU alumnus. He earned his master's degree here, and he is the author of the book Andrew Jackson, Southerner. Jackson's political opposition to the creation of a national bank and his minimalist approach to a federal government, they're right in line with the states' rights mentality of what ultimately became the Confederacy
right.
after his death.
Right.
But he was not in favor of breaking up the Union.
Right.
Unpack that for us.
Jackson, again, as we talked about before the last break, he's a complex man. He is a Southerner, and we tend to categorize all white Southerners prior to the Civil War during this antebellum period as being the same. And the reality is that you had different kinds of white Southerners. And Jackson represents some of that complexity. So as you mentioned, on the one hand, he does talk about a minimalist federal government. He wants to, in the case of the bank, the national bank, he wants that bank out of the way. He wants it destroyed because he believes it has too much influence on American society and the American economy. On the other hand, in the winter of 1832-33, he fights against John C. Calhoun and the South Carolina nullifiers who want to break up the Union over the tariff issue. Jackson, I think you have to characterize him as a Southern nationalist most of the time. Most of the time he is in favor of the federal government being sacrosanct, being sacred. But there are instances when he's not, and I'll give you an example. Indian removal. When it comes to Indian removal in Georgia, he doesn't involve the federal government in that on the side of Native Americans. He allows Georgia to exercise its state's right over Native Americans. So, and he's doing that, in fact, at the same time that he's fighting the nullifiers in South Carolina. So on the one hand, he's supporting the strong federal union. He's supporting this idea of the federal government against South Carolina. But at the same time, he's allowing Georgia to exercise its state's right, even in the face of a Supreme Court decision that said that the federal government should be involved. So it's a very a complex situation politically for Jackson. That may be part of the reason why he reacts the way that he does. But I think it's also his identity as a Southerner, that he is not a South Carolina nullifier. He's not someone like Jefferson Davis later from Mississippi who becomes the Confederate president. He's an Upper South Southerner and Upper South Southerners tended to be more gray on the matter of states' rights than those in the Deep South in particular.
I think when you get from Tennessee, Kentucky, and then moving on up to Southern Illinois, Indiana,
right.
and Ohio,
right.
up in that neck of the woods.
Right.
Jackson has a reputation, and perhaps this is a caricature in the minds of most of us, as someone who said what he thought and thought what he said and was outspoken about what he thought and was not given to hedging his bets. Was this a man capable of compromise?
While Jackson and Calhoun and the nullifiers are posturing in public, you know, Jackson claims he's going to march the army down to Charleston and hang every damn nullifier from the nearest tree, starting with Calhoun. While all that's going on, Jackson, Calhoun, Henry Clay, and others are working behind the scenes to try to work out a compromise so that this situation doesn't devolve into secession and civil war. There are times when Jackson can compromise. But again, I think it comes back to that public reputation that he has for violence and for being no nonsense. He uses that to his advantage, even if in the background he is working to find a way around some of these very tense situations. Texas gains its independence in 1836, and Jackson is still the president. In fact, his good friend Sam Houston had helped lead the Texas Revolution. So it was a perfect time for Jackson to take Texas, to make that territory part of the United States. And he doesn't do so. And the reason he doesn't do so is because he calculates that if he were to bring Texas into the Union, it would hurt Martin Van Buren's chances to become president. Because Van Buren, and this is one of those situations where Jackson has to walk a fine line, as does Van Buren. Van Buren was a northerner who needed southern support, so bringing Texas in would certainly help him. But at the same time, it might alienate those northern voters who would see Van Buren as a pawn of southern voters. So Jackson calculates that the best thing to do is just let the situation lie, let Van Buren, if he wins the presidency, which he does, let him handle the situation.
Did northern politicians and northern socialites look down their noses at Jackson?
There's a woman by the name of Margaret Bayard Smith in Washington, who's a very famous Washington socialite, who, when he's elected, is recording in her journal and in letters all these atrocities that are taking place during the inaugural festivities, that you have this mass of unwashed people who come to Washington who want to see that their president, they storm the White House or the President's Mansion, as it was called then, and they tear down the wallpaper and they get their muddy boots on the couches and they're only lured out by alcohol and ice cream. And so she paints this picture that really has stuck of Andrew and Rachel Jackson coming, or at that time Rachel's dead, but of this inauguration of Jackson's presidency. And the reality is that certainly there are some people who come to Washington who are like that. And there's no question that the events that she describes happen. But historians recently have suggested that a lot of those people are office seekers, that they're journalists, that they're people who are not, you know, these unwashed masses from the backwoods, but they're actually people who are like Jackson. They want to make it in the world. And so they see this guy as their president. And so that's why they come to Washington.
They're trying to hitch their wagon to his star.
Exactly, exactly.
Break time again. We'll be right back with more MTSU on the Record.
The Army ROTC College Program at MTSU prepares students mentally, physically, and emotionally to become leaders and promotes virtues of duty, honor, country. ROTC cadets are involved in all academic disciplines, athletics, and student organizations at MTSU. Full scholarships and tuition assistance are awarded based on merit. All cadets upon graduation will serve their country as second lieutenants either in the Army, Army Reserve, or Army National Guard. For all the latest MTSU news and information, go to mtsunews.com.
Dr. Mark Cheatham is our guest. He's an MTSU alumnus and author of Andrew Jackson, Southerner. Well, the South is known to this day as the Bible Belt. What evidence, if any, did you find about the role of religion in molding Jackson's character?
I've been asked that question a lot in interviews. Jackson, again, back to complexity, he is someone, when he's younger, his mother apparently wanted him to become a minister. That was one of her career goals for him. And obviously, he doesn't do that. He's a religious man, or at least he's a spiritual man. He references the Bible. He references God or providence frequently in his letters. But he doesn't join a church until after the presidency. And it's the church that he actually built on the Hermitage grounds for his wife, Rachel. He is someone, I think, who is religious, but he doesn't want that to be mixed up with politics, or at least that's what he says. So there's a depth to him spiritually, but it is not something that comes out very frequently in public. It's something that you'll find in his private correspondence, particularly with Rachel, who is extremely religious, extremely pious. And it comes out with other people as well. But it's not something that's part of his public persona. And so how much influence that has on him, I think it has some influence, but certainly not to the extent that you see with some 20th or 21st century presidents.
Do you consider Jackson to be a great intellect? Not so much?
I wouldn't call him a great intellect. He is educated to an extent. He probably had what we would call today a middle school education. He reads widely, so he's familiar with, you know, the Enlightenment philosophers, and he keeps up on politics. I wouldn't call him an intellect, though. I think when I think of an intellect, I think of someone who's you know, extremely well educated, very well read, someone who, you know, can quote at length from the great philosophers. And Jackson can do that to some extent. But I think a lot of his education we would call today street smarts.
We'll take one more break and we'll be right back. This is MTSU on the Record.
The Middle Tennessee State University Women's Studies Research Series features compelling monthly talks on gender-related topics by faculty and graduate students. The series offers a chance to learn about research in progress and to chat with faculty in an informal setting. All lectures are free and open to the public and are held on the MTSU campus. This is Associate Professor of Journalism, Dr. Jane Marcellus.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
In our final moments with Dr. Mark Cheatham, author of Andrew Jackson Southerner, this is a chicken and the egg question, but did Andrew Jackson mold the South into what it ultimately became, or did the South mold him?
It is a chicken and egg question. I think it's a little bit of both. I think Jackson was shaped by his experiences in South Carolina and North Carolina. I think as he's exposed to the elite men there, the men who are bound by kinship ties, the men who own slaves, as he's shaped of that by that, he brings that to Middle Tennessee when he moves here, and then he in turn is shaped by the Donaldson family and William Blunt and others in Middle Tennessee. So I think he's shaped by his background, but he also shapes the South. And the clearest, to me, the clearest example of that is his expansion of Manifest Destiny into the Southeast. By removing Native American tribes, he creates a regional vacuum, a land vacuum in the South that becomes the cradle of the Cotton Kingdom. And then that, of course, expands into Texas, which, even though he doesn't bring Texas into the Union during his presidency, he's a strong advocate for that that relationship, that bringing of Texas into the Union up until the day he dies. And so I think in that sense, he creates the South. So I think it's a little bit of both. He's shaped by the South, by his Southern background, and then he also helps to create the antebellum South.
And I wanted to mention this before we left you. You grew up playing ball on the land that was the last gathering place of the Cherokees before they departed on the Trail of Tears.
I did. Red Clay State Park in northern Georgia is about 10 miles from where I grew up. And we took school field trips there, church field trips there, played softball and walked that land. And I've always been struck. I really didn't have an interest in Andrew Jackson when I was growing up. It wasn't until I went to Cumberland as an undergraduate that I became interested in him. But as I look back now, I can see that there were some influences there even when I was growing up that I wasn't even aware of.
Dr. Mark Cheatham is an associate professor of history at Cumberland University in Lebanon. He is an MTSU alum, and he's the author of Andrew Jackson Southerner from Louisiana State University Press. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
MTSU On the Record, a news and information program about Middle Tennessee State University, is produced by the university's Marketing and Communications Office, which is solely responsible for its content. Read more about MTSU at our website, mtsunews.com. Podcasts of this program are available at mtsunews.com and on iTunes.